Hi all. I wanted to hop on really quick before this episode started and give a quick trigger warning. We talk about racism, ableism, medical racism, brief mention of rape, microaggressions, eating disorders, and specifically being weighed at the doctor's. And then I also wanted to hop on and give you guys some resources. We talk about them a lot in this episode, and they're all linked in the show notes. But just so you guys know, we have some resources up for LGBTQ provider directories, trans provider directories, BIPOC doctor registries, and also some health buddy guides if you want to bring someone to the doctors with you. We also included the Chronic Notebooks Mental Health Specialists for Disabled Individuals guide and their master doc that is just phenomenal. So all of those are linked in the episode notes. We also talk about them a lot in this episode. And then we have some more resources that are linked on mindfulmindspod.com. And then lastly, I just wanted to share that we recorded this episode in September, so it has been a hot second. And since that episode was recorded, Iman, our guest for this episode, has changed their Instagram tag. So you're going to hear us reference the old Instagram tag a few times, but just so you guys know, the updated Instagram tag is at disabled.bipoc, B-I-P-O-C. So if you're looking to follow Iman, which I would really suggest you doing, that's the Instagram tag that you're going to want to look for. Other than that, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Iman is an amazing individual and has done some amazing work for the disabled community, and I hope that this episode is as educational for you as it was for me. Enjoy.
Hi, all, and welcome back to Mindful Minds. Thank you so much for joining us today. Today, we're going to be chatting about BIPOC disabled activism with Iman of Amplify BIPOC Disabled Voices. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so glad we were able to have you on. We have been trying to make this work for an extended period of time, and schedules keep getting in the way and sickness and a whole bunch of stuff. So I'm so happy to finally have you on. Your page is one of the few of its kind that I've seen, which is why I wanted to have you on, because I think that there is a lot of disability activism going on. We had Claire of a little bit of Clarity on a little while ago, and that was fantastic. And I really appreciate your page just literally featuring people that are disabled and part of the BIPOC community. And I wanted to have you on to cover a few things, but also just because I think that your page is unique and it is important. So do you want to give us a little bit of background as to yourself and why you center this topic on your page?
Sure. So I'm Iman, pronouns she, they, and I am 22 years old. I started experiencing chronic pain at age 16. And I would say in the past couple of years, I've been a part of the online community for chronic illness and disability. And so that's kind of how I got into this and how I realized I was disabled as well. And then I got, I met a whole bunch of people, became closer to friends, and my friend actually started this page, Amplify BIPOC Disabled Voices, and added me as co-founder. And so I was really excited because we both shared this interest in, creating a space that is needed, has always been needed, and just didn't exist. Like you said, there's not very many of them. And we just wanted to make it a place where you could share other people's stories, like you said, or whatever people wanted to share, just because we wanted a space for specifically BIPOC people in the community. As I think that is really important because it's a very whitewashed community. They don't really get the attention they deserve. And I just wanted to make sure those issues were brought to light. So yeah, that's kind of the reason behind the page and a little bit about me.
Yeah, I love that. And I think it's a good point. Even I think that disability representation in general is one of the kind of fields of oppressed groups of people that have gotten left behind in a major, major, major way. And even when you look at representation in media and stuff, the way that it often goes when representation begins and starts to become more common and more seen in media or in even, you know, TV shows, social media, magazines, books, features, anything, is often white people get to go first. And there's often a lot of white representation before there is BIPOC representation. And so I initially was introduced to disability activism and even just disability representation through a lot of white communities. Like, that was what I was introduced to through it first. And so I love that there is, that you saw the need for a community, and you saw the kind of the, I guess, missing aspect of it, and the group of people that ironically enough are often left behind, and yet still, even when we're trying to represent and trying to move forward, they still get left behind, which you'd think that we would get it by now to prioritize those groups. I really appreciate that you saw the need and just created a page. I think that's the, we had someone on a little while ago, or actually it was our last episode, Christina Rodriguez of Latinas with Masters. And we were talking about just, if you see an online community that it doesn't exist, make the fucking podcast, make the Instagram page, like, just start doing it and create the community, and you'll be amazed to see how many people realize, oh, I'm a part of that. Or, oh, I noticed that was missing too. So I really appreciate you just taking charge and doing that.
Yeah, thank you so much. I honestly was super excited to be a part of it, and something I've always been passionate about. I think that it's so important. And like you said, it's missing. And it's like, if we're talking about all these issues, how are we leaving it out of this issue with disability? How are we completely removing BIPOC people from disability when, you know, disability is so common for BIPOC people, and just, you know, because of the trauma, because of so many things, it's like, we can't exclude such a big percentage of the whole population of disabled people. And right. I just think that it was so important to also have it so that people could see that they weren't alone, because it can feel so isolating as well.
Right. Yeah. And we're going to talk about some of the different ways that, people who are in the BIPOC community end up continuously receiving more oppression and become more marginalized because of the color of their skin, even within the disability community or even just within the world, because they're disabled and a part of the BIPOC community. So we're going to go into that a little bit. But before we start, I wanted to kind of ask you, I want to start with the why, I guess, because for people who aren't disabled or aren't a part of the BIPOC community, that's a tongue twister. Why is it important to address the intersectionality there? And why is it important to bring attention to it? Because I think even a lot of the ways that just the disabled community in general are, especially in the pandemic and especially in the conversation surrounding COVID, have been so pushed to the side and often are not thought about, and there isn't intentionality and there isn't thoughtfulness there. Why is it so important to address intersectionality when it comes to disabled activism, specifically within the BIPOC community?
That's a good question. I think that intersectionality within the BIPOC community, or disabled community, specifically with BIPOC, is because I think so many of the issues that disabled people face are specifically target BIPOC people. Honestly, they target BIPOC disabled people. They, like, poverty, you know, as a disabled person, you're more likely to be in a lower class. And I think that people know that Black and brown people also tend to be in the lower class. So it's like, it overlaps in multiple ways. Medical racism, there is even just the trauma that people face in the BIPOC community makes them more susceptible to becoming disabled, from, you know, developing trauma that causes chronic illness, from how they are not treated properly or cannot get the help for the conditions they deal with. There's really just so many reasons, but those are just a few of them. And I think that those reasons alone are so big. And with the pandemic right now, I think that one is really important, is that when people work jobs where they're more likely to get COVID and just be exposed to it and, you know, not in a safer situation. A lot of those people are in the BIPOC community and disabled people as well because of how they have to work lower class jobs.
Yeah, and that's a great point to bring up the susceptibility, because that's not something that I had thought of, that if you are, I think the world in general really underestimates the impact of trauma. And I think that trauma gets underestimated and overlooked. And even when we're talking about single traumatic experiences, like something that is a single flashlight event, you can light bulb event, and you can go back and you can think about like, oh, this one day was really traumatic for me. I think that society in general expects it because it's something, we think of trauma as, oh, this person was in a car accident, or, oh, this person went to the war and then they came back. And so they're removed from that trauma. And I think that often the expectation there is that you'll get over it really quick, and that you'll go to therapy and you'll get some, you know, anti-anxiety meds, or you'll figure out some coping mechanisms, and then you'll be done with it.
And which are all privileges.
Right, exactly.
That not everyone has.
Yeah, and so I think that the expectation that you kind of just, all right, let's move on. And the thing that my mind likes, like, often compares it to, because this is something I've been learning recently, because I definitely bought into that narrative where I experienced trauma in my own life. And because I had this societal expectation and had this expectation of myself to just like, all right, let's move on. Like, we're over it. Let's go. Reminds me of grief. And if you lose a parent, people are there for you for a certain amount of time, then they expect you to be over it. And I think that the thing that people often don't understand about trauma is, let's say you have one traumatic event, like one single, you know, March 22nd, like that was a traumatic day for me. Something really bad happened on that day. That alone can impact you for years and years and years, not just mentally, but it can impact your health. It can impact your finances. Maybe you're not in a state to be able to be as financially sound. Maybe the cost of therapy and the cost of medication tanks you financially. Maybe you're not able to work a job anymore because the weight of the trauma is too much. Maybe you develop some sort of impulse control because of trauma. And that's one that doesn't get talked about enough either. So it can impact you financially. It can impact your health, your weight, your ability to feel like you can, even your ability to eat. Like, a lot of times people feel like they start not being able to have full meals because they can't stomach them. There's all these different things that it can impact for years and years and years. And then you look at a community like the BIPOC community that has been experiencing trauma at the hands of the world for years and years and years and years. And we're talking generational trauma on top of generational trauma on top of generational trauma. And then you're expecting those people to not have any long-lasting impacts, and not even expecting them to not have any long-lasting impacts, but not recognizing when they do. And so it makes a lot of sense that that could very easily kind of bleed over into health and developing chronic illnesses. And if you look at the science, you look at the statistics behind trauma, like it impacts your brain. It impacts your skin, your gastrointestinal system, your muscles, your back. Like, you can carry trauma in your neck and your back and your hips. Like, there's all these different things where trauma is very, very intertwined with how the body works. And that's such a good point. And it's so important to bring up that you're not just looking at, oh yes, well, once these people are disabled, they're at a disadvantage because of the way that the world works and systemic racism. But then additionally, they have a higher chance of becoming disabled because the world overlooks their trauma and doesn't give them the resources that they need.
Yes. And they have a higher chance of, you know, not getting the help once they are in that situation, or, you know, not even realizing they are in that situation and not being, not given those accommodations, not given those treatments, and just, you know, continuously getting worse, just all those different things. I think it's really normalized. There's a lot of stigma in the BIPOC community of all these things because we're expected to be, you know, strong and all these things because you've had to be. Like you talked about with trauma, I also did not know I experienced it for a really long time because it's like, it doesn't show up in those few ways like car accidents, and like just those few things that you hear about, there's so much more. And I think the biggest thing that I've learned is that trauma is how it impacts you, not what. And that is a very like heavy experience. And I think that that is not fully something that people know outside of the community who've gone through trauma, just because when you are a part of the BIPOC community and you experience racial microaggressions like all the time, you know, that does add to your load. Like you said, carry on your back, you just feel like, I don't know, like you're more anxious, like more, you're more depressed, like just in general, it's like you're normal, quote unquote. And so it's hard to tell when things get like to a higher point. And a lot of people don't recognize it or don't think it's a big deal. And it's easy for us ourselves to do that too. So I think that a lot of that is why there's a big need in recognizing the difference in the community. And I think that a lot of people think that, you know, oh, we're all disabled, we all have the same issues. It's like, yeah, we do all have that battle, but that doesn't mean that people don't have their own other battles as well. And I think that that's the difference in when you are a part of the BIPOC community and you're disabled.
Right. And there's privilege everywhere. And I think that's a thing that has been lost in the conversation recently. Because it's funny, people can only handle learning so much. And so I think when you have kind of this like renaissance of learning in the last few years, where people who never understood what racism was are like finally kind of grasping it, I think that trying to teach people everything about racism and systemic racism how, you know, all of these different types of things work, how trauma works, how trauma plays into it, what's generational trauma, like all things get lost and fall between the cracks. And so I think one of those things that has fallen is that white privilege is obviously very real. And then there's also privilege where, let's say that you are white and straight, you have more privilege than a white queer person. You are white and not disabled, you have more privilege than a white disabled person. Like there are levels to privilege, and kind of I view it as almost like with every battle you have, you kind of, and this might sound very like too materialistic, but with every you know, additional, I don't know, weight to add to your load, you have like a little card where it's like, okay, this is one thing that I have to carry. And when you look at the sheer amount of cards that, you know, specifically, if you look, I think I'm going to butcher this because I don't know exactly who it's from, but there was a quote that talked about the fact that the most oppressed person in America is the Black woman. And then someone revised it and said, the most oppressed person in America is the Black queer disabled woman. Like, that's the most oppressed person in America. And so I think that if you look at the number of cards, the number of things to carry on your load that maybe a white queer disabled person has, a Black queer disabled person has so much more. And does that mean that both battles are not super valid? No, but it means that if you're caring for one person who has a broken leg and one person who has all of their bones broken, one person's going to need different care than the other person. That doesn't mean that both injuries aren't valid and don't deserve to be recognized and validated and affirmed and taken care of, but there's going to be a different level of care for each person. And I think that the normal instinct for humans, who often like to view things in a very black or white, yes and no, right and wrong way, and also really don't like to feel like they are not important. I think that's kind of just a human instinct. It can be kind of this gut reaction to, well, hang on, like I'm important too, and my needs are important too. And once again, we're going back to really cliche kind of elementary school ways of explaining privilege and racism, but privilege is not pie, and equality is not pie, and having one person getting a bigger slice than you doesn't mean that you don't also get a slice. Like, it doesn't have to be, it's not that black and white. It's so much more nuanced than that.
Definitely.
And with that all being said, what would you say if there is an individual who's listening, who is realizing, ooh, maybe my level of activism and maybe my level of allyship is not as intersectional as I thought it was? What would your advice be to that person to try to elevate the intersectionality in their own allyship?
I think the biggest thing is taking yourself out of the conversation. Sometimes just passing the mic, letting the other person tell their story, because we cannot understand that. We just can't. Like, I know everyone's like, oh, I understand. It's like, no, I do not. I feel for you. I do not understand. I cannot possibly understand the battles that I do not go through that they do. And I think to sit back and just let them speak, let them tell their story, and give them maybe the page for it. If you have the like audience and you want to help, maybe have people come and talk on your page, since you have that audience that they may not have the access to. I think that making room for those conversations, but not taking over them, is the most important thing. And remembering that it's not about you, and that like what you were saying, I kind of talk about this a lot, but with privilege, your privilege does not invalidate your trauma. You are like, everyone has privilege. There's going to be some, but it doesn't invalidate the trauma that you've gone through. And I think that it's important to recognize the difference between that, because recognizing your privilege doesn't mean your trauma is just invalid. And I think that's where it gets confusing for people. And I think that when you want to bring attention and help and be an ally to these issues, sometimes you use your privilege to help them, actually. Like, I know as a thin ally, I can offer people, people might listen to me more about fat disabled issues just because I'm saying it. And so sometimes I'll just pass the mic to someone to speak on it, and they'll just be more likely to listen. And it's like, I don't like having that privilege, but we can use it for good. And I think that that's important to recognize. It's like, you cannot like having white privilege, but if you have that privilege, maybe have those tough conversations with your white, non-disabled friends. Have your conversations with white disabled people in the community. And it's going to be uncomfortable. It's not going to be easy. And I think that's important to recognize, is that when things are difficult and you're not completely understand, you don't completely understand the situation yourself, it is not going to feel like you know everything about the topic, because it's not your experience. But I think that it's helpful to either pass the mic to someone, or also to have those conversations that people are just not having. And I know a lot of people will be like, oh, I'm tired of being like the educated white person that has to explain it. It's like, well, you know, the BIPOC community is tired of being the ones to explain it just because they exist. And so what you're feeling is a fraction of what they go through all the time. And if you really want to help, that's one of the biggest things you can do.
Yeah, I always find that argument so silly. The like, oh, I'm so tired of being the person helping explain it. I think that the expectation that people should have to educate other people on a topic that is triggering and traumatizing for them is not fair. Expecting Black women to explain racism to a white woman. You're asking someone to go in and relive their trauma and re-traumatize themselves and trigger themselves in order to educate you, when you could just educate yourself. Or you could find resources from people who are willing to do that explaining, because there are lots and lots of people who have written books, who have done YouTube videos, who have made movies. And I remember in June 2020, there was a lot of people DMing every Black person in their life to explain racism to them. And I think that, like, when I'm thinking of experiences, like you said, you don't understand experiences that you haven't been through. So when I am thinking of experiences, the way that I think this is just a human way, is you often relate it to your own life of like, okay, how can I compare this to something I've been through so I can understand it a little better? And the way that my brain went was like, I'm a sexual assault survivor. And if there was a massive, massive, massive debate in the world about rape, and I had everyone coming to me and being like, hey, can you explain rape to me? I would lose my mind. Like, I would be so triggered and so traumatized and feel so burnt out. And so the expectation that people should have to relive their trauma just so that you get an ounce of education is wild to me. Especially considering that there are already so many resources available and honestly readily available. Like, I think that not all resources are available to everyone, but being able to maybe pass the same book around your group of friends, maybe one person has the resources to buy a book. I'm not just referring to one topic either. Like, if one person has, a book about disabilities and they found it really helpful, maybe you pass that book around your friend group if everyone can't afford to go out and buy a brand new book. There's ways to spread resources that don't require, a lot of, I guess, output for people. Even, you know, if you have access to a phone and you found YouTube videos and TED Talks, and, if you have a Netflix subscription, I know that I've heard a lot of people talk about Crip Camp and how beneficial that movie was to their educational journey and their journey of learning what ableism is. There's so many different resources that are relatively readily available. And with all that being said, we talked at the very beginning, very briefly mentioned medical racism and the fact that, as we're talking about resources and what's available and what's not available, that often the same level of care given to a white non-disabled person or even a white disabled person is not going to be given to a BIPOC disabled individual. So let's start with, what is medical racism for people who are hearing that term and have absolutely no idea what we're referring to?
Sure. Medical racism is prejudice and discrimination in medicine and the medical healthcare system based upon perceived race. I say perceived race because it might not be what they assume, might not be correct. You know, that goes with being white passing and different things like that. And I have some, like, I guess, examples that can help with this a bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, just BIPOC patients have a lower life expectancy. They tend to have worse access to healthcare. They're often dismissed more by medical professionals. They tend to get diagnosed less quickly, have worse prognoses, regularly don't receive adequate treatment. And there's even a study that showed that white people more readily recognize pain on white faces than on black faces, which I think because, you know, it's just because we're so almost numb to the reality of, like, black people experiencing pain because they just always have. So it's like, oh, it's nothing, which is not true. And so it means that BIPOC community does not have access to adequate treatment for pain. I'm someone who has eczema, and I was misdiagnosed at first because they didn't recognize what it looked like on my skin. So, you know, there's, like, a lot of different things, like skin conditions and different things. Like, they don't know what different conditions look like on people of color. They don't know what, you know, it will be like for a different experience. Because when the whole, like, medical system is based around, like, white cis males, I find that excludes so many people. And there are a ton of people outside of just that community. It's so easy for them not to get the help they need, to get misdiagnosed, to be treated poorly. You know, there's the medical gaslighting that happens on top of just with medical racism. So I think that is something that's really important within medical racism, as well as just how, even if they do, like, even if they are able to help you, they might not actually know what the condition looks like for you.
Right.
So it's like, oh, yeah, okay, I finally get the help, but now they don't know what to do and they don't know what this is. And it's because I'm not white.
Right. And it's help, quote unquote, you know, not actually helpful. I think it blew my mind when some studies and some research came out about medical textbooks, because if you are not a med student, you don't know what medical textbooks look like. And I found it so interesting when that started circulating about the fact that medical textbooks, if you are learning biology or physiology or anatomy, and even like thinking back to my high school experience, I never right. saw one anatomy textbook that wasn't a white body. There was never one anatomy textbook. Yeah, you're never seeing even you think of sex ed and you think of like learning about like. Even if it's not specifically talking about a skin condition, if you're looking at, say, like a health textbook and you see the outline of a pregnant person and you see the inside, you see their uterus, you see the baby, yada, yada. Okay. They're always white. Like, even though right. that's not specifically studying the skin condition, the models, the images, the graphics, it's always white individuals. And then if you see, sometimes in health textbooks or anatomy textbooks, they show actual photos of people with those conditions.
Yeah.
Always white people. And it makes sense that, and this is not to like pat doctors on the back, but it makes sense that if at the right. very core of its being, medical curriculum is biased and is centered on whiteness, that if you see something, it might not be intentional bias that you're misdiagnosing. It very well could be that you were simply taught to treat white people with more care and attention than black and brown bodies. You were taught what things look like on white people, how to treat it, how to get them better, and you weren't taught that for black and brown people. And so we go back to the whole privilege thing and the pride and the people having a hard time admitting that even if they are not intentionally trying to harm people, they might still be harming people. It might not even be at the very basis of the bias intentional. It very well could just be that the system is so broken and so racist in its nature that you're, even if you want to be the best doctor in the whole world and you have the medical textbooks that are only showing white bodies, you might still have a bias. And then you go on the other side of that and you talk about medical gaslighting and you talk about, black individuals being expected, specifically black individuals being expected to deal with more pain. You have the racist studies that go back years and years and years and years and years in medical communities that black people feel less pain than white people and that their brains are different. And you have all these different things that are so grossly racist in their nature. And in my opinion, that then takes some of the intention because I think that there's right. enough resources in our lifetimes to do your own research and do your own due diligence and learn why those things have been disproven, why it's important to believe black people when they say that they are in pain, why it's important to believe black people when they say that something is wrong in their bodies. I remember going to a doctor once and kind of was a little sheepish because I had something that I was like, I don't really know if anything's wrong, but something feels off. And I felt kind of embarrassed because I was like, you're the professional. And whenever I get into medical situations, I have such an authority complex that like, if I'm in a medical situation and the doctor says you're fine, I'm like, okay, sure. Yeah, I'm fine. Like, so sorry. My apologies. Like you're the boss. I'm so sorry. And that's not my personality. I'm a very like confrontational, like ready to stand up for myself type person. But in a medical environment and an educational environment, I often kind of sink back and feel shame and discomfort. And I remember having a doctor yeah. tell me, well, no, like you're the boss of your own body. Like, you know what your body, you know how your body works. You know your body so much better than me. I've done schooling, but you know your body. And similarly, we had Cassandra Dunbar on a little like way, 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 way back of Be Well Sis. I think it was like episode 7. And she talked about the fact that like she has, and I might be butchering this, but I believe she has like a master's or a bachelor's in, I think it's biology. And she was talking about how in her experience, and I've mentioned this before on the podcast, like even after this episode, because this story really stuck with me, that she was pregnant and was trying to get care for her pregnancy because she felt like something was wrong and was being told, as someone who has a literal degree in a field of science, that she was wrong. And luckily, she was able to get the care that she needed because she pushed for it. And not everyone has the comfort or the even just the confidence and the confidence in their education and their knowledge of their own body to feel comfortable enough to push that boundary and say, hey, I think you're off on this. But it's
definitely
it goes so deep. And I think that's the thing that is hard to even cover in a podcast, is it's like,
yeah,
there are so many levels of this that are so deeply rooted And that's why it can feel really overwhelming when you're learning about it, because it's like, well, I can't change decades of systemic racism. Like, how do I do this? And so with all that being said, how can non-BIPOC individuals or non-disabled individuals advocate for BIPOC disabled individuals in the medical space if they're not a doctor? I know if you're a doctor, obviously you can do the research, you can look into the figures, and you can, there are textbooks now that are so much more inclusive that are being rewritten, and they are, you know, images and graphics and models that are being redone to actually be inclusive. But if you're not a doctor and you can't completely change the medical space, how do you still advocate and still try to create a safe space for these groups of people so that they actually get the care that they need?
I think a big part of it is community. It's really important because so many people don't have community. And if you are able to, I find sometimes it's nice if it's not triggering for you or anything to even just accompany these people to these appointments, to help them with, I don't know, groceries, different things that just helps them during these tough times. They seem very separate from this conversation. But when you're that overwhelmed in this area, those little things can be so much more. And I think that community can be a big part of it. And sometimes when you do those things, you just learn because you hear about what it's like. And that is, like you said, the person knows best. So really just, I think, believing and listening, hearing people out about their experiences, making sure you just question when people talk about things. Hey, are we looking at another point of view? Is there anyone talking about this point of view? There is someone out there who has this. So, you know, I'm sure it's out there. What can we do about this? And even if you're not the one to find it, just thinking about it and like bringing it up just leads to more people having that thought. And I think that someone out there will just continue to think and research, and it can get somewhere. But like the little things like community, accompanying someone to an appointment that could be really triggering when you go through medical racism. Sometimes, like I said, using the privilege of being white and accompanying someone who is not white to an appointment and standing up for them, that is huge. I think that that is a really big one. As someone who's not disabled, accompanying them to something, standing up for their accommodations that they need, just really believing in those people and basically doing what they are trying to do but are not being believed to, by you having that privilege of, you know, being listened to because you're not in that situation, getting that help for them and finding a way. I think that's really helpful, and I think that can be really make a big impact on so many people's lives when it really just feels like they're just not being even heard. It's like, oh, you know, like you said, like if a doctor doesn't think that someone knows what's going on and they have a, you know, a master's in biology, it's like, okay, I shouldn't have to go find another master's in biology. I am a master's in biology, right? So it doesn't make sense. But sometimes when it's like that, like I find that when I take my dad to my appointments, I'm just listened to way more than when I go with my mom. It's so annoying. It's just true. And he's not able to go very often, but when I have a really tough one, he helps me. And that's because he has the privilege of being male. And they're just like, oh, he knows what he's talking about, and he doesn't appreciate that, but he helps me because he knows they're going to listen to him. And so I think like in a situation like that, you can use it for good, which is why I think, again, it's good to know what your privilege is so that you can also use it for good. So if you're denying your privilege, you're also not able to use it to help people.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's been a lot of, I think, a common response to the white privilege conversation or the privilege conversation in general is, well, I don't have any, or even like, well, I'm not going to, I don't tap into it. Like I don't like it. I don't want to use it. And I think that people don't realize how counterproductive that actually is. Cause I think that there can be simultaneous things happening. You can be doing the work and, being a part of communities and maybe financially supporting communities if you can, that are helping actively dismantle the system that has created the privilege, But to be totally real, that's going to take a long time. Like these are systems that have been in place for an incredibly long amount of time. And so you can do two things at once. You can be actively dismantling and try to help and promote and educate and support financially or support with your time or your energy or whatever, while also trying to use what you have at the moment before those systems are able to completely be brought down for continuing support. And I think the thing that's also lost in the conversation is if you're using your privilege to, like you said, pass the mic or give a voice to someone, let them use your platform, whatever, or even if you don't have a platform, using it to help educate or promote or whatever, doing that is also actively helping dismantle. So you're doing two things at once. It's not like those are mutually exclusive. And I think that people often view those in very separate boxes in their head, where I can only do one of the two. And if I do one, it cancels out the other. And I don't think that's true. I think they're actually they're intertwined, and they actually benefit each other. If you do one, you're benefiting the other.
Yeah, I think the overwhelming feeling that people get when they cannot, when they feel like, you know, they have too much to learn, too much to work on, and they want to deny the privilege. That's the very thing that could help with that overwhelming feeling of being like, oh, it's too much. It's like, well, sometimes when you're learning what is wrong and learning what you may have, where you may have privilege, they're going to help each other out, actually. So I think sometimes what we're scared and what we're overwhelmed by is what helps us in the end with both situations. It's like, I've learned that the most, I think, is like I told you, you're going to be uncomfortable. You're going to be in a situation that you don't know what it's like. And so that is going to make you recognize your privilege. And then that is going to make you help. Well, if you go into that, then you'll realize, okay, because I have this privilege, that doesn't mean I want to step away from this. Okay, so then what can I do? And that means using your privilege for good. So I think you end up going there very quickly if you stay in that path. And I think that it's very important. Another thing I wanted to bring up is mutual aid. I know that's a very big thing in the disabled community. It's a huge thing for the BIPOC community. And I think that just sharing, just spreading the word is huge. I know people who will just, you know, do like food deliveries. They'll, you know, just little things like that. And those things are huge. Just really giving to the community in whatever way you can. Sometimes for me, really just saying, I'm thinking of you, or, you know, I will do the most I can. Like, you know, you don't have to do the most. You don't have to give all of you away for someone else. Like, I think that's really important to recognize, is like, you still have to take care of yourself. You still have to put your needs first. And there's nothing wrong with that. Being disabled, being all these things, you also have to take care of yourself. But I think that just sometimes letting people know that you see them, you hear what they're going through, and you support them, and that what they're going through isn't okay, is just so validating, and just almost will make people so emotional because of how invisible it makes you feel going through all these things, how much people just want to push everything under the rug. Like, you know, the amount of states that hide the homeless, in San Francisco, everyone's like, oh my gosh, there's so many. I'm like, it's because they don't hide them.
I'm in Seattle, so I'm, very, very similar. And even mutual aid in even if we go into then the houseless community, I mean, you're talking about such a massive percentage of the houseless community are disabled BIPOC individuals, and mutual aid is massive there. And following accounts that highlight that, which I know your account does that, and I literally was looking at your story today, and you had so many different things that you'd reposted about mutual aid. Now that there's Cash App and there's Venmo, and there are ways to try to like send money so quickly, it's so much easier to give mutual aid, and it doesn't have to be massive amounts. $5 or $10 can make a really big difference. And I know that there are a lot of different accounts that literally dedicate their entire account to that. including like location based. Like I said, I'm in Seattle and Homies Helping Homies Seattle that's their entire account. And it's phenomenal. And it's constant, just community help. They just did summer survival bags. They've done so much different things, tents and sleeping bags, like drives and fundraisers. And that's a really easy way to just like hop in real quick and give whatever you have, if you have funds.
Yeah. I think when you start somewhere, sometimes it's best to just start where you are. People think about so many different countries, so many different places in the world. It's like, you could just start where you are. There is a community where you are. They are everywhere. So maybe just like start where you are, see what's out there in your area, and maybe just help the community around you. And I think sometimes that can make it a little less overwhelming than looking at the whole world and all their problems, because I know that we're all overwhelmed by how many things are going on and we can't all fix it overnight. And like you said, it's going to take a long time. So, you know, I think those little things will make a big difference and can help us learn from each other and be more kind to each other through everything, I think.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And I do want to just really quick as a resource, wanted to circle back to the medical racism aspect, because I wanted to just mention really quick that another thing that you can do in medical spaces, if you're feeling like you're not listened to, or even if you have, I know so many people have so much massive anxiety entering medical spaces, whether that's from previous medical trauma. I know sexual assault survivors have a really hard time going into annual appointments because of pap smears. People who have eating disorders have a really hard time entering in because they're worried about getting weighed. So a few tips for that I have learned simply through experience. For one, in terms of advocating for yourself, there are scripts that are published online that you can print out a literal script or write your own script as to what you want to say, things that you want to bring up in your appointment, how you'd like to say it. And that way, if you have brain fog, if you get flustered, if you have anxiety, you can write everything down and print it out or have it on your phone and just literally list everything that you need and be able to have that ready to go. Even if you're thinking from a debate perspective and you're concerned that there's going to be some sort of rebuttal from the doctor, have responses and statistics ready. So that you're able to have all of that prepared, almost as if you're entering a debate space. If you have someone who can come with you, have them be in charge of that. Have them do that research. If that's a way that you can help someone and be an advocate for them, you can do that research. You can do that legwork. Simultaneously, have someone take notes. A lot of the times, if you have brain fog, if you get overwhelmed, if it's an anxiety-ridden space for you, having someone taking notes or taking notes yourself, or even voice recording the appointment if you get permission from your provider, can help a lot. That way, a lot of times doctor's appointments can go very fast and be very confusing, and you walk out and you're like, "What the fuck just happened? I don't remember anything."
Yes.
So that can be helpful. I've heard from different doulas that that's especially helpful in a birth space, is making sure that you have an advocate who can take notes for you. If you are dealing with sexual assault trauma, walking into a doctor's office, you can always inform, or you can even email or do something that way. You don't have to if it's too nerve wracking to say it in person, you can use a messaging service. A lot of doctor's appointments have online messaging services to inform your doctor and your care providers that you are a survivor, and that if you're concerned about specifically a vaginal exam or a pap smear, that you can be incredibly explicit about that and say, you need to ask consent for every single thing that you do. You need to explain every single thing that you're doing. I need to give verbal permission before you move forward in any way. And also, you are always, always, always able to stop that appointment. I've had people that I've talked to who have gotten pap smears and are survivors and have had really severe anxiety about I got really uncomfortable and I was in pain and I didn't want to stop. You are allowed to say, "Oh, I'm done. Thank you. I'm leaving." You are allowed to walk out of an appointment. That is within your rights. You are always allowed to do that. You're always allowed to deny care. And then with eating disorders, if you're anxious about weight, you can always let them know that and you can refuse to be weighed. You are more than welcome. That is a thing that a lot of people aren't aware you can do in a medical space.
I learned that recently too. Yep.
You can refuse to be weighed. You can also tell them that you want your weight taken off of your chart. So that when you get that printout, you don't have to, what I did for a while was I just got on the scale backwards. And then I'd get the printout of the after visit summary and it would have my weight.
And I was like, you still get it. Yeah.
I was like, fuck, like I haven't weighed myself in 3 years. Like I don't want to see that intentionally. So I just started entirely denying getting weighed. Cause I was like, I know my body enough that if I have a drastic increase or decrease in my weight and I don't know why, I'm going to know that. I'm going to know like why this is way different than normal. But I know that my weight has not really fluctuated. There's not a concern. I haven't had any other symptoms that would maybe concern. Like if you have like a thyroid issue, like maybe, you know, a weight up or down can actually be a big deal. And that can be a thing that you need to inform your medical provider. But I know that's not the case for me right now. And so I just started denying getting weighed. And then lastly, you're allowed to change providers. I had a provider that was incredibly judgmental about the fact that I was sexually active. She was religious and decided to implement her religious beliefs in her medical care. And I mentioned that I wanted an STI test and she got really judgmental and, was like, why would you need an STI test? Like you're only 18. Like, are you sexually active? And I literally was like, oh, I'll wait till next time, but thank you. And went up and was like, and I'm switching providers. And when I informed, I also reported and informed them that that was something that had happened because you are paying someone for a service. Either your insurance company is paying for someone for a service or you are out of your own pocket. You are allowed to interview that person. You are allowed to decide whether or not you like them. You are allowed to switch. And obviously that all comes within resources and privilege and what you're able to afford and all of that. But if you're able to switch a provider and you don't like the provider that you have, that is well within your rights. It might not be well within your resources, but it is within your rights. And so that's important to be aware of as well. You can also go on and like review and rate doctors. If you have a doctor that's really problematic, you can leave them reviews. You can rate them. There are online communities that rate providers and that way other people can be aware of if a provider is maybe not LGBTQ plus affirming and they showed some sort of bias or if they have some sort of medical racism bias or something, you can note that. And then, there was one more thing I was going to mention that I'm forgetting now. There are also, platforms and, providers online that, are both, specifically the one I'm thinking of right off the bat is, Dr. Jennifer Lincoln, who is a OBGYN who provides a lot of different, resources for, abortion care. And if you're a survivor and you're fearful about medical exams and gives a lot of information from an actual MD who is sitting there and giving you information that she has learned and providers that she knows are safe providers. So there are people online and in online spaces that give that type of care as well. So those are just some few resources that I have either learned myself or been told or, you know, whatever. But medical spaces can be really tricky. And at the end of the day, it's your care and you are allowed to advocate. And and that's once again, all within, if you have the available resources, if you have the available mental energy, all of that. But there are ways to kind of lessen that load on you. And once again, if you're someone who can accompany someone, you can do that legwork and you can do that research for the person that you're accompanying so that they don't have to deal with that. And you can just be the person that is advocating for them.
I think that that's really important to mention because I recently realized that I've been going through a lot of medical trauma and I was going to ask my primary care to kind of just tell my specialists that I was seeing either new ones or current ones just to kind of let them know what's been going on so that they're kind of prepared because I couldn't bring it up every time. And I think that sometimes finding a provider that is like willing to have those discussions within the different specialties or different fields is really helpful so that you don't have to have that work on yourself. And I found that to be really beneficial, just like lowers my anxiety a little bit when it's, like you said, it's such a stressful environment. And I just really appreciate all those sources because I definitely know that that would be helpful for me and so many people out there. And I'm sure that for so many of us having to learn, we just want to share them with everyone else because we wish that we had known too. And I relate to so many things that you said, and I just really appreciate you sharing those with us too.
Yeah, of course. I've gone through a lot of random trauma and shit that then has made medical spaces uncomfortable. And so, I so wish I had the resources right off the bat, because I did a ton of doctor's appointments where I had to see my weight and I came home crying, and I did pap smears where I came home feeling violated. So it's like, there are ways to prevent, further trauma. And of course, like we said, trauma isn't something linear. It's extremely up and down, and it can impact you in any way. And, your body determines what's traumatic for you and what isn't. And so even something that's not traumatic for someone else might be very traumatic for you. And we've all I'm of the belief system that every single human being has experienced trauma in some form. I don't believe there's any person that walks the earth that hasn't experienced some sort of trauma, unless they're a very small, small, small child that maybe has had a really easy first go of it. But even in that, birth is traumatic. If being birthed, you being the person that's being birthed is traumatic. And so I think that trauma care is so important, and trauma-informed care is so important. And if any way that you can try to lessen the amount of trauma that you have to put on yourself is a benefit. And people think that maybe going to the doctor and seeing your weight won't be a big deal, but for some people that can be something that sends them out of remission or whatever. Like, it can be a really, really big deal for some people. And so trying to reduce the trauma in any and everyone's lives is something that I find really important. And with that all being said, mental health is another thing that I wanted to mention just at the end of our time here, when we're talking about different types of impact. And we talked about kind of that if you're in multiple marginalized and oppressed groups, how that can impact your mental health and how it can kind of add up and start to accumulate trauma after trauma after trauma after trauma. And now you've got all these cards in your hand of different things that are, you know, on your load or on your back. And so I think we've kind of covered how it can impact someone's mental health, but if it's impacting someone's mental health, what are the steps to try to find mental health care when someone is a person of color and disabled? Do you have any tips or any resources that might help, or, I guess even shorten the road, I guess, to try to get to that care? Do you have any tips for that?
I guess for me, honestly, it's just some of the things that you've said as well. Looking for, like, there are guides online and sources of providers that are like LGBTQ affirming and different things. Like, I think if you're looking for a certain area, like, but it's, I'm trying to think of specifics, because the reason why is just because there aren't very many resources specifically for BIPOC community. Like disabled people in the BIPOC community. And I find that within mental health, it's even rarer, because you'll get all these mental health help from white people. Yeah. So I think one of the biggest ones is, if you're able to, finding like providers that are like in the BIPOC community. Sometimes people who are disabled themselves can really understand. I think community is huge. For me, community was one of the biggest things. This online community, I've made so many friends. I've met someone. I've just had so many people. I think that when you share experiences, it can be really helpful, because it's so isolating. It's traumatic. That you feel so alone, and your mental health is already struggling. And I think going through all of that, it just makes it so much harder. I think finding community, so that you don't have to find those sources by yourself, is huge. You could share them with each other like we just did. And I think that's one of the biggest things I would say, because I really don't have specific sources, because there really isn't a lot of places to find them that are specific to the area, specific to whatever. And I think that, like, for me, being a South Asian Muslim, queer, whatever person, like, it's just hard to find that. Like, it's hard to find like guides that fit all those intersectionalities within everyone, you know? And so I think you have to kind of, sometimes it helps to find the communities so that they can guide you, because like we talked about, those people had to find them and they're happy to share them. And I think sometimes that's what is needed the most. I'm still trying to find like more than that, but that's what I keep coming up with when people ask me that question, is because so much of the online like mental health community is just a lot of white people. And so that just is really difficult to share other experiences and, you know, find that, those sources that you need, because sometimes it just feels like they don't exactly fit what you're looking for. Yeah, so that was like one of, but I was going to ask you as well if you had anything that you were going to say.
Yeah, so I think the specific BIPOC disabled resources for mental health, I agree with you. I haven't come across a lot of those. I do, however, have some mental health resources for BIPOC individuals in general that isn't quite so specified to disabled individuals as well. And specifically, if you go on, I just created a new website that has a resources page because I was accumulating all of these resources basically on a Google Drive. And that's not the best way to try to like, you know, publicize them. So the website that I just launched is for this podcast, and it's mindfulmindspod.com. And if you go to the resources tab, I have basically, tried to, I guess consolidate as many resources as I can for as many different topics as I can. And a lot of them have been resources that people have either shown to me via the podcast, like guests that I've had on, or have been ones that I have created. And so within that, I have resources, for deconstruction, because a lot of my podcast centers on deconstruction. And then, under the mental health tab, we have mental health master document and worksheets. And under that, I have a master document that I made in June 2020, that centers primarily on BIPOC mental health. And then, an individual also gave me permission to share their master doc that they made. I might not be pronouncing this correctly because I've never actually met this person, but, I believe it's, Michaela Webster, M-I-C-A-L-A-H Webster. They made a master document and gave me permission to share. And so in their master document, and I don't know how updated this is either because we're talking a Google Doc that was circulated in June 2020, but, Blackline is a 24/7 national crisis support hotline, for BIPOC individuals. It's also operated with an LGBTQ plus, Black femme affirming lens. And then they had, a resource on here for 7 mental health resources for Black people right now from at Jessia Sparks, J-E-S-S-E-A Sparks. And they listed Dive In Well, which I've heard a lot about, Sister Afia, Therapy for Black Girls, Heal House, Inclusive Therapists, which is a database to find therapists that celebrate and shares your identity. They also offer reduced free teletherapy. Ethel's Club and the Knapp Ministry, which both of those I've heard fantastic things about. I know the Knapp Ministry focuses almost exclusively on trying to find rest and mental health support to BIPOC individuals because, like we've mentioned, trauma is exhausting. And then on my master document, I also listed out lots of different hotlines that are not necessarily BIPOC exclusive. I introduced some different resources for meditation, yoga, even there's a company called Brown Sugar Yoga, which is a yoga studio for people of color only. I also included some BIPOC accounts to follow that center on mental health. So at Refined Therapy, at the Unplug Collective, at the Knapp Ministry, at Healing Well Black, at Be Well Sis Podcast, which I, like I mentioned, I had Cassandra Dunbar on of Be Well Sis. She's phenomenal. At Black Men Heal, at Redefining Black Masculinity, at Evian Whitney. I don't know if Evian is still doing the same work that she used to do. There was a lot of different resources there for meditation for Black folks. And then Evian used to have some workshops, and I'm not sure if those are still available, but I know they used to be. And then lastly, on my mindfulmindspod.com page, I also have some abuse and trauma resources, and then I have an abortion master document that I created and then kind of got semi-approved slash looked over by Moji Alawode-L of at Abortion Front. Moji's been on the podcast twice, and she's incredible and is doing a lot of on-the-ground work with Marie Kahn of at Midwest Access Coalition, which is an actual coalition that is providing support for people getting abortions in the Midwest and funding their transportation, their housing, their lodging, their food, their childcare. And so as much as, like we said, so much of this is intersectional, abortion care plays into mental health care. And so there are some, the master doc there I made in June 2022. And it is dense. It is dense as hell. It is a pretty massive fucking document, and I try to update it as much as possible. But it's got abortion directories. It's got where to donate. It's got hotlines. It's got books. It's got movies. It's got podcasts. It's got as much as I could fit on there. And if you are a listener and have additional resources for mental health care, for specifically if you are someone who has found a BIPOC disabled mental health resource that you think is really beneficial, please feel free to message me or message Iman, and like we can try to figure out how to get that on the resource page. I'm adding resources pretty constantly and making sure I'm vetting them and stuff. But that's kind of the mental health resources that I have. Once again, I know that's massive, but all of that is on my website under resources if you're looking for a more consolidated place to find that.
Okay.
But yeah.
That's great. Thank you so much for sharing that. I have yet to check out your website. I'm super excited. And I wanted to mention that there is like a master list made by Nia of the Chronic Notebook on Instagram of like a bunch of BIPOC, chronically ill and disabled people. So those are just like a bunch of names like on that list. And
that's from who?
You can find the Chronic Notebook, Nia,
okay.
On Instagram. So it's just like you can find a bunch of advocates or just people that are in that situation that kind of share about those things. Different, like I find that can be helpful sometimes. There's Chronically Brown by Suk Jin, who has been huge for me because it's like a South Asian chronically ill disabled community. And there's AADI Initiative, which is the Asian American Disabled something.
Yeah.
Initiative, probably.
Yeah, probably.
But, you know, like a bunch of those. There's Black Disabled Lives Matter. There's like some of those types of sources, and I'm happy to send those to you. Yeah. As I cannot fully think of them right now, but I definitely have found a bunch of pages and different things that are nice, like even for community or different things, like not necessarily mental health sources, but they do make different things like guides and hotlines and different things are put together and like into a guide, like you were talking about, kind of like a list. So I find that sometimes those types of things are helpful. And of course, there's Amplify BIPOC Disabled Voices for all of you as well. To share a story or to ask us for any of these things.
Yeah, for sure. And I actually just popped on the Chronic Notebooks, link tree. And they also have a specific document of mental health specialists for chronic illness and disability that actually lists out medical providers. So that's fantastic. Yes. And then they have the advocates guide that you mentioned. And I'll actually reach out to them specifically and see if they're comfortable with me reposting those resources on my website and redirecting people to them, because I'd love to add like a disability and disability advocate or activism portion to my website. I'd love to include that.
Sure. I know she has a post on her page as well. I could send it to you that has like all the names on it. So it's publicized in that way as well. So like you could reshare that on your story or whatever. Cause I know I have it on the Amplify page and it has just like a bunch of names. There's me and like a ton of other people. It's really helped me find more people in the community and it's been amazing. So I'm always happy to share that too.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much. Do you have anything else that you want to plug? I want to make sure that we get everything. I know your Instagram is, you have the @AmplifyBIPOCDisabledVoices, and then your personal Instagram, A Little Bit of Faith, which is spelled AlilBitOfAith. Other than that, do you have any other ways people can reach you?
I think those are the main ways. So
perfect.
You can find both of them in each other's bios as well. And there's like other links to like, you know, other social media like Twitter. If you want to, like, if you have your hashtag, you can hashtag #AmplifyBIPOCDisabledVoices and we'll find you. Just wanted to mention that as well.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I'm so glad we finally got to do this.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time that we have for today, you guys. Thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please rate us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify and leave us a review. You can also follow the blog on Instagram at Serafina Blog. And you can visit us online. For the podcast, you can visit us at mindfulmindspod.com, which is where that resources guide is. And then you can also visit us online at serafinablog.com for the blog posts, poetry, and songs of the season. And then you can follow us on TikTok at Mindful Minds Podcast. And then you can follow me on TikTok at Fina_Bina, FINA_BINA for more deconstruction content. And as always, to end our time, unclench your jaw, take a deep breath, and remember, you can always learn, you can always grow, and you can always choose to live your life in a more mindful way. I will chat with you guys in 2 weeks.